From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As a mass of protesters gathered outside, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, or TPP, was signed by a group of senior government officials in Auckland, New Zealand, Thursday. That, despite the fact that polls show the majority of New Zealand's population opposes the deal. The protests in Auckland were widely anticipated in the South Pacific Island. Activist Mohsen Siddiqui was there and spoke with some of those in attendance.
Hello, good afternoon. Could you tell us, our listeners, why you are here and what is this all about? Why are Kiwis out and about protesting today?
Basically, we are protesting about a document that is about to be signed that has not been transparent at all in its full entirety. Even now that they say the full text has been released, there are documents that sit behind these that are the fine print of this agreement. Now, if this was an agreement good for this country's economy, as they state, and that it was good for the health and welfare of our people, surely we have a right to see these documents and reassure ourselves, because constantly we've been told in the past these documents they sign overseas have been good for us. If you look around rural New Zealand and their last boom and bust industry called the dairy industry, you can see that this is not the truth. Our rivers now run so toxic that I have to warn people in my own hometown not to swim there, and yet I swam there as a boy.
Wow. Thank you. Hello, good afternoon. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's happening over here in Auckland and why are you here out?
Well, I was just to the police cells overnight. I am a political activist. My name is Dennis the Menace. I am a role model citizen, but in the eyes of the law, I am a terrible human being. I am what they call a good cunt. But however, the police view it as something entirely different, and the subject of the matter is I am not allowed to do what I want to do in public. So I have to be discreet now, remain low-key, and be a good boy, as they say. But I'm not a boy, I'm a man.
Are you also part of the TPPA protests?
I was going to be, but I was in the cells overnight, so therefore I'm not allowed to be. I'm heading back to the police station to collect all my money, my skateboard, and my Budweisers, and then I shall return home to drink my Budweiser.
What do you think about the TPPA?
I think it's a load of corporate bullshit. I think it's invading our privacy, personal space, gives corporates the free reign to do whatever they want in our country without our say in the matter, and yeah, it's just a bunch of
Thank you.
The French government continued to seek an extension of the state of emergency Wednesday. This after large protests filled the streets of Paris over the weekend. CCTV's Kate Parkinson filed this report from Paris late Wednesday.
The spokesperson for the French government said on Wednesday that the terrorist threat here in France remains extremely high, which is why the state of emergency is still necessary. He said the emergency measures have been extremely useful in the past few months and must continue to be so. Certainly, the enhanced powers of arrest and ability to carry out raids have been extensively utilized by police here in France in the past few months. They've carried out more than 3,000 raids on properties and hundreds of people have been placed under house arrest. The government is currently asking for an additional 3 months, but actually the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls has hinted that the state of emergency should stay in place as long as it takes to defeat the so-called Islamic State militant group. So while the current extension is for 3 months, there are many who wonder whether the actual emergency measures will remain in place here in France for considerably longer than that. And it is actually extremely controversial. Although polls show that the majority of French people are in favour of the emergency measures, there are also some very vocal critics. Certainly at the weekend, thousands of people rallied here in the French capital, calling France a police state and calling on the government government not to extend the emergency measures. And earlier in the year, a group of UN human rights experts appealed directly to Paris not to extend the emergency measures, saying they place excessive and disproportionate restrictions on key freedoms and the special measures undermine the democratic principle. Despite these criticisms, the likelihood is that the government will manage to get this proposal through Parliament. The Parliament will debate it in the coming weeks and vote on it later this month. It needs to be approved by both of France's Houses of Parliament, and it is highly likely that the majority of French lawmakers will vote in favour of extending this state of emergency. Kate Parkinson, CCTV Paris.
You're listening to the CPR News from Community Public Radio.
We are fighting imperialism. We are coming from the former colonies, and we think that the French state is a colonial state. It is an imperialist state, and we live inside this state.
That was Horia Bortildia, activist and spokesperson for the indigenous people of the Republic, speaking with host Tariqa Lee about France's conflict with its imperial past and why politics in France continue to move towards the right, with the rise of racism and Islamophobia across the country in the wake of the recent terror attacks.
And we feel responsible because, in a way, we get benefit from this situation. We are lower class people from the worker class, etc. But we are just like in relationship to Africa, for example, we are in a situation of relative advantage.
You have certain privileges.
We have privileges. So we are fighting imperialism. So we can say our own privilege, but we are fighting racism because in France, we are not the equal of the other French people.
And yet the proud claim of French parties of the left and the conservative right, not the extreme right, for many decades has been that France is a republic, that all its citizens under this republic are equal, and they have explained this fact to argue in favor of discrimination, particularly against Muslims, but against Arabs in general. And this much vaunted republicanism.
It's a myth. It's a myth.
It's a complete myth.
It's a myth. And we know it's a myth. But people of color know it's a myth because they are the victims of police violence, of police crimes for 3 decades in France. 90% of the people dying from police violence are Arabs or black. This is the first thing, but there is another problem. The big discrimination at a national scale. People from the suburbs who are mostly black and Arabs and Muslims are suffering 3 or more times from unemployment. They are discriminated from the job, from employment, from school, etc., etc. So there is a systematic discrimination against non-white people.
Which is institutionalized.
Yes.
Why is it that France in particular has developed in this fashion, Horia? I mean, I was amazed in 2005 when there were riots in the banlieues, when the French police went and after the French police went and killed people, that in these riots there was very little solidarity from the left or the far left organizations.
That's true.
Now that couldn't happen in this country.
That's true.
So how do you explain the sort of depth of this, that it's not just the rest of France, it's even left-wing France or far-left France, which is cut off from any work of solidarity?
I think that, first of all, we have to consider geopolitical issues. I think that that the French state is declining, first of all. And the French people usually feel themselves as central, but now their power is declining, first of all. The second thing is that as racism is increasing, as the governments do not have any solutions for the poor people in France, racism is rising. But in the same time, the left of the left, the radical left, was not able during 30 years to understand the problems of the suburbs. For 30 years, people from the immigration, people of color, said, we have problems. Our problems are racism, discrimination, and violence, police violence. These are our main problems. And we are pro-Palestinian. Okay? These are our issues. The left was never able to understand this and to make it in their program, to make these issues in their programs. But they did worse than that. They supported the law against the veil that was promoted by the socialist and the right parties. Okay? So this complicity of the big parts of the radical left with the institutional, with the government, was just like a trahison? Une trahison?
That clip came from the program Dossier, hosted by Ali, which airs on Telesur. It was from the February 3rd edition of Dossier. Sukant Chandon is a London-based political analyst and filmmaker and runs the blog site sonsofmalcolm.com. We spoke with him via Skype from London Thursday. Sukant, welcome. A pleasure to speak with you, as always.
Thanks for having me back, brother.
So you saw the piece with Tariq Ali, and that's a discussion that's going on all over Europe, all over the world, really, but particularly in Europe and in the United States, Australia also, right? And give us your thoughts as someone living in London, originally from India.
On the conversation between Tariq Ali and Huria Botelja.
Yeah, that and writ large to what's happening generally.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, just to give you a little bit more context. Now, I've met Comrade Huria several times at conferences in London. It's our exchanges at these conferences is on YouTube. I'm one of the coordinators of the Malcolm X movement. And last year at our first annual film festival that we organized, the Indigenous of the Republic were a supporting organization.
That's her group, yeah, right.
Yeah, that's the organization that Huria leads. And also, I know Huria Botelja is a part of Decoloniality Europe, which is a supporting organization of the work of the Malcolm X movement this year, which we are terming the Year of the Panther. It's the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panthers, and most of our work is dedicated to that this year. And Decoloniality Europe, which Huria and the Indigenous of the Republic are part of and supporters of, they're supporting our work. So there's a constructive relationship between organizations that I'm part of and that Huria is part of. But like, you know, any two comrades, we have some disagreements and some critical conversations to have. And so when I listened to the very interesting conversation between Tariq Ali and Huria, by the way, I've never actually met Tariq Ali face to face. We are aware of each other and each other's political work, but have not to date made any direct contact.
You know, what would be really useful, people here in the United States, for example, have no idea what's going on in Europe in terms of the, you know, we get all this blather about immigrants and riots and, you know, fighting, but the actual content, what's happening and, looking past the imperial gloss that's presented on everything in the U.S. media, what's really happening on the continent? Maybe you
I don't think it's that different to what's happening in North America, Brother Don. I mean, there's obviously there's differences region to region, country by country, but broadly it's very similar things, which Tariq and Hurriya touched upon in their conversation. It's the massive rise of far-right, racist and fascistic views on all levels of society, from the populist levels of the masses to state level, where politicians are increasingly, especially in places like France and Britain and across Europe, are adopting the same far-right narratives and rhetoric of the fascist organizations. So a central part of this is, and Tariq and Hurriya didn't touch upon this at all, actually, which is rather amiss, perhaps, in the conversation, the so-called refugee crisis. And a central part of old-school Nazism and fascism is that the quote-unquote Jewish Bolshevik, to use Hitler's expression, was some kind of existentialist threat to the Aryan order of Germany and Europe.
Right.
And the Jewish Bolshevik was a racialized minority of people. And it's a very clever thing, because it combined at once the greatest resistance to the fascism, which was the communist movement, so that's the Bolshevik part of the quote-unquote Jewish Bolshevik, and then a racialized scapegoated other, which were Jewish people. And similarly to that, and the parallel to that, is that Europe is saying, from the center left right to the far right, it's saying that that our brothers and sisters who are escaping wars today and colonial wars before, that looted and destroyed their countries more or less, that them escaping in great numbers to Europe is some kind of existentialist threat to Europe. It's not. Europe needs these people. It's always needed these people, especially since the post-Second World War period, to service the economy, to meet the demographic crisis of Western white people, etc., etc. Now, that's not in the conversation with Tariq and Hurriya, and that needs to be there, because it's only with placing this and inputting this element of the general situation that we can understand it in its totality. The other thing that Tariq and Hurriya don't mention is that Tariq asked Hurriya why Maghreb heritage French people have joined Daesh and Al-Qaeda and Arab Peninsula to conduct terrorist actions in Paris. The thing that Hurriya did not mention, which I don't understand why she hasn't mentioned that, and in the whole conversation she doesn't mention it, that France is a leading part of neo-colonial wars today in Libya and Syria. So on the one hand, the French state is saying they're against terrorism, but they seem to only be against terrorism when it impacts Paris, but they're facilitating and supporting the exact same terrorism, and frankly, worse, in Libya and Syria and further afield.
And they used it also to recolonize Cote d'Ivoire only 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, exactly. And I think the fault lines in Comrade Hurriya's narrative is this, is are you French or are you not French? And of course, if we've grown up here, we adopt accents and the language of the British or the French. So I'm not saying we got nothing to do with the countries that we have grown up in. Of course we do. But I'm talking about politically, and I'm talking about that frame of political understanding that Malcolm X had, that the Black Panthers had, and that others have had, radicals in the West, that Malcolm said, you can't understand what's happening in Mississippi unless you understand what's happening in Congo.
Right.
So, and similarly, we can't understand what's happening across Europe in Paris or London unless we understand what's happening in Tripoli and Benghazi and in Damascus, etc. And that's what's absent in the conversation between Tariq and Hurriya, which is strange, because Hurriya correctly says and brilliantly says that the French is an imperialist state, it's a colonial state, and they're against imperialism. But France is in a continuing covert and overt war in Syria, in Libya, in Mali, in Algeria, etc. Sister Hurriya herself is of Algerian heritage. And the French have not given up in overthrowing the Algerian state, because it still remains a relatively political radical state of the global south. The Algerian state has very close ties to Vietnam, to socialist Korea, and to Zimbabwe, is a leading member of the African Union. And there's many other things to state, and there is clearly still an imperialist project. They want to Arab sting Algeria. But that's absent. So we can't bemoan or oppose these issues of racism and terrorism within London or Paris unless we oppose the same thing, and perhaps primarily oppose the same things in Libya, Mali, and Syria. So that has to be a part of it. And also, what's also missing in the conversation is French collusion, as I've mentioned, with this terrorism. Mm-hmm. So the French are in open alliance with the same political forces that conducted the Paris attacks of Charlie Hebdo and the Bataclan, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's a clear issue of collusion there that we have to discuss and we have to talk about. These guys can what? Organize and facilitate and enact very elaborate terrorist actions in Paris, and then in the case of Charlie Hebdo, two of the attackers drove through France, drove through Spain, took the plane to Turkey, and escaped to Syria. Can we really say that the intelligence services of West Europe are so pathetic that they can't monitor these things, or there's something else afoot here?
Maybe they gave him a ride. One of the things that I find most troubling from the perspective of, gee, maybe we don't have as much work to do and instead getting, the counter idea from it, is how easily so many on the left completely fold in the face of racism. They adopt it, espouse it, they dress it up in nice language, but, this the whole idea of this nation, state, nation, people thing is supposedly the opposite of a unified global working class that doesn't recognize boundaries as a concept. And yet, it's presumed whenever they have these discussions on the left about what is to be done about the migrant crisis, like they accept as valid the existing constructs across the board.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, the problem is that the Western left, or what I call the imperialist left, not the left of the global south and more broadly, they've never been able to critique and strategically oppose the imperialist order. The left have always, in general, there's some exceptions, but in general, and there's some contradictions there as well, but the Western left in general have wanted to have greater amount of crumbs from the imperialist cake. Mm-hmm. I.e. the welfare state, the social wage, mm-hmm. in the West is predicated on colonial looting and genocide that mm-hmm. continues today. So the left have never said, look, we don't want to be a part of this imperialist project. We don't want our social wage to be based on the super exploitation and the blood and the bones mm-hmm. of hundreds of millions of people in the global South. They never said that. Right. So this absence of critical analysis and this presence of a colonial framework has never been questioned, and it informs everything the left say and do. Then sometimes they're not aware of it, because many times imperialist racism and white supremacists are not aware of the depth and profundity and extent of their own colonial outlook, because it's just normalized. It's just the way it is.
Right.
Sugar and spice and all things nice. Well, sugar and spice came from the colonies that were robbed and looted by vicious colonial policies. Mm-hmm. But sugar and spice and everything else is an integral part of the West now. It's normalized.
Right.
We use petrol from the global South. It's normalized. The whole existence and the whole existence of the left is predicated on imperialism. And unless the left can understand that, of course they're going to be racist. Of course they're going to see immigrants as competing for their living standards and jobs and housing, etc., and not understanding it's the imperialist system that is actually facilitating and feeding these divisions and this poverty, relative poverty, that is in the West.
Let me interrupt for 1 second. Because on that point, a vigorous critical analysis from the left would essentially see the people who are coming to Europe following the wealth that was taken from them and their countries or their areas, their regions.
And they're just going to where the warmongers and the money bags are based.
Right.
And the warmongers and money bags who are making their money, having their incredibly lavish, parasitic, decadent lifestyle directly on the suffering, on the basis of suffering of our people. So, of course, you've got to have a bit of a human approach. But as the crisis is deepening, the intelligence services, the media, will be promoting this white supremacy and rising new fascism, I call it. I call it the 21st century fascism across the political spectrum, and they're doing that with devastating effect. That's where Tariq and Huria's conversation is also very interesting. Huria very rightly and honestly, I think, appraises the depth of the challenges and the problems that we're facing. She makes a very interesting comment about the way the brothers and sisters in the Banlieues, in the suburbs, that's the black and brown youth, working class youth there, oppressed youth there, are voting in quite big numbers for the far right. Such is the confusion, political confusion, that we are seeing now. I think Huria doesn't mention this, and I don't know what she would say about this, but I think the growing popularity of the far right amongst white people, but also amongst some second and third generation black and Asian people in the West, is also a part of the conspiracy theories that have a very similar political framework to fascist ideas. Mm. So for example, this obsession with Rothschilds,
I know, right.
with the Illuminati, with the Bilderberg Masons, Group, etc. You know, and with Alex Jones, David Icke, etc.
Lizards.
They're just repackaging old fascist a framework of analysis, mm-hmm. and that is seeping en masse into our young people, and they're falling for this. So when they hear the far right, they somehow see some more relevance as a result of the collapse of political leadership of anti-imperialism in the world. They see that as a viable project. We're going through a very, very deeply problematic period here in Europe where fascism is proliferating and there is no sign of resistance. There's small, tiny pockets of some spontaneous resistance that's not strategic in capacity at all. It's a very ugly period we're going into.
You know, and looking at the large geopolitical picture, you know, on the one hand, it seems that that which is arrayed against the U.S. imperial project, EU, is greater than was during the Cold War in many ways, with the placement, with the whole map in the Western Hemisphere is different. It's not just Cuba anymore. China is the largest or second largest economy, and in real terms, by any measure, largest economy in the world. All of that is going on the one hand, but during the time of the Cold War, there was an ideological battle that didn't just rest on an amorphous concept of imperialism and national interest, but of class interest and anti-fascism in one, ardent anti-fascism in one camp. You don't have that going on anymore.
You don't have it as clearly as it happened, yeah. And you don't have it to the extent that happened before. I think the last people who really tried to project any revolutionary leadership across the world was Hugo Chavez and Muammar Gaddafi, and they're both gone. I mean, indeed, Muammar Gaddafi's project was destroyed exactly because it was so much of a radical threat, not only to Africa and the global South peoples and countries, but also Muammar Gaddafi was an absolutely exceptional third world leader in as much he very consciously reached out to black and Asian and white working class struggles in the West. For example, he supported the miners' strike here in Britain, the women of the striking dockers in the 90s in Liverpool, but also supported the Nation of Islam. And I mean, in England, mm-hmm. I mean, there's hardly a black and Asian organization of the 70s that didn't get funding and support from Muammar Gaddafi and the Jamhuriya. We don't have that type of political leadership anymore. The Chinese are not putting out, internally in China, there's many interesting debates and conversations happening.
Absolutely.
But on a state level and globally, they're not going to have some kind of anti-imperialist class analysis happening in Europe.
It's just like a ministerial approach. They're just like, here's our plan. We're just going to work on that. You all do what you want to do.
Well, you know, in the bigger global struggle against imperialism, China is an absolute leading force politically, economically. Mm-hmm. And I think people like us, we can take what the Chinese are saying and we can develop it and promote it further. Mm-hmm. But yes, the Chinese are not doing it. But, you know, frankly, the Chinese need to develop their country, uplift mm-hmm. their people, strengthen their military.
Yeah, we got some stuff we should be doing, too. It's not up to China.
Yeah, China, you know, we shouldn't expect everyone to save us. And that's where I think Huria's conversation is interesting with Tariq. because perhaps she's putting too much onus and responsibility on the white radical left in France.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.